From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the judicial record of Judge Samuel Alito, President Bush's nominee to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. We'll talk with Cass Sunstein, a professor at the University of Chicago Law School, an authority on constitutional law, and author of the book Radicals in Robes. The neoconservative magazine, The Weekly Standard, is celebrating its 10th anniversary with a new anthology. We'll talk with William Crystal, founding editor of the magazine. He started advocating the overthrow of Saddam Hussein years before the invasion. The invasion has turned Iraq into a laboratory for terrorists, according to the new book, The Next Attack. We'll talk with the authors Daniel Benjamin and Steve Simon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've invited constitutional scholar Cass Sunstein back to our show to talk with us about the judicial record of Judge Samuel Alito, President Bush's nominee to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Alito was unanimously confirmed to the U.S. Court of Appeals in 1990 when he was nominated by President George H.W. Bush, but he's a more controversial nominee for the Supreme Court and faces liberal opposition. Cass Sunstein is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School, a contributing editor at The New Republic, and author of the new book Radicals in Robes. He wrote an op-ed piece on Alito in today's Washington Post. You write in your op-ed piece in the Washington Post today that his decisions have been almost uniformly conservative, and usually when he dissents, he has a more conservative position than that of his colleagues, and that you could see that in his dissents on civil rights cases. Can you give us some examples of that?
Yeah. In his 40 or so dissenting opinions, when they have an ideological dimension, he's almost always on the conservative side, opposing sometimes conservative colleagues. There was one case where a woman and her 10-year-old daughter were subject to a strip search. They were asked to take off their clothes, and this pretty clearly violated their constitutional rights because there wasn't a warrant to tell these people to do that. And they sued, saying their constitutional rights had been violated. The court said that the case could go forward because it was a clear violation of their rights, and Judge Alito dissented, saying the police had qualified immunity. His opinion wasn't lawless. It had some basis in the law, but it was a bit of a surprise that he would strike out in dissent in that way. There was a recent case involving prisoners in segregation units who were banned from receiving newspapers or magazines, even from the prison library. The court struck down that ban as violating the prisoners' First Amendment rights. Judge Alito dissented. He said that the ban was in the prison's legal power. There was a case involving a Hindu temple, a little relevant to recent debates about church and state, which had land use restrictions imposed on it, lots of them, including they had to have off-duty police officers there to monitor and protect the site. That's what the local zoning board required. And the court said this is very hard to defend, these restrictions on the Hindu temple. They're arbitrary and unlawful. Judge Alito dissented, saying that what the zoning board did was perfectly legitimate. And this is consistent with the general pattern of his decisions in dissent. And I guess what I'd say unifies a lot of them is deference to established institutions. So if it's a prison or a university or an employer or police officers, he is protective of them, less protective of people complaining that they violated the law.
And what are the larger, what's the larger significance of that?
I guess what I'd say is that Judge Alito isn't someone like Justice O'Connor, who was unpredictable in her outcomes. He's someone who, at least on the Court of Appeals, when he's departed from his colleagues, has always gone or almost always gone in the same direction. So if some Democrats and moderates are nervous and some conservatives and Republicans are happy, it might be because this is someone who seems to be of a predictable mind on some of the great issues of the day.
Since abortion is an issue that both the left and the right are measuring Judge Alito by, let's take a look at abortion. It seems the strongest indication we have on his judicial opinion on abortion is in the case Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Would you summarize for us his dissenting opinion in part of that case?
Yeah, the part of his opinion was actually quite prescient. He predicted that the Supreme Court would ultimately adopt the undue burden standard for evaluating restrictions on abortion, and he was quite right on that. The court eventually was persuaded to do that by Justice O'Connor. Where he wasn't so prescient was that he voted to uphold a part of the law that required married women to notify their husbands that they were going to have abortions, and he was in dissent there because the majority of the court concluded concluded that most of the time married women are going to notify their husbands, and when they're not, there's probably some problem, very possibly fear, even physical fear. And in cases of that sort, the majority said this was an impermissible restriction on the woman's right. Judge Alito disagreed with that. He said that this was not an unconstitutional restriction, and the Supreme Court eventually disagreed with him.
What does that tell you about his larger judicial philosophy on abortion? Does it tell you much?
I think it does tell you something. I think it strongly suggests that he is not going to take an extremely firm hand against restrictions on the abortion right that fall short of elimination of the abortion right. It wouldn't be at all surprising if Judge Alito thinks Roe against Wade as an original matter was wrong. It wouldn't be a shock if Judge Alito ultimately votes to overrule Roe against Wade. I think this is a tea leaf we actually can read, that when there's a restriction on the abortion right that doesn't go to the heart of the right, doesn't eliminate it, Judge Alito is probably likely to listen with great respect to the government's arguments.
So you think it's likely that he would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade if it came to a vote?
I wouldn't say he'd vote to overturn Roe against Wade. That's a quite momentous decision, and any person would have to think long and hard before doing that. I think what's clear is that he is likely to be receptive to efforts to protect the interest in fetal life that don't eliminate the woman's basic right to choose abortion. What I'm talking about now are things like restrictions that involve parental notice requirements, restrictions on so-called partial birth abortion, efforts to qualify the right that fall short of eliminating the right. That's the domain in which we're going to see a lot of action in the next 5-10 years.
Let's look at Judge Alito's opinions on states' rights versus congressional authority. Do you want to choose a decision that you think is particularly revealing on that subject?
Yes, there's one that's actually quite revealing. It's a very big deal. The court in the 90s, that is the lower court, was confronted with someone who possessed and actually sold machine guns and argued, the defendant did, that Congress doesn't have the constitutional authority to ban at least the possession of machine guns. The court ruled that Congress did have that power under the Commerce Clause, saying that machine guns typically travel in interstate commerce and they affect interstate commerce because of their connection with crime. Judge Alito, in a very striking dissenting opinion, argued that our system of constitutional federalism, as he rightly described it, forbids Congress from banning the possession of machine guns, that there has to be some requirement, some in the law, that the machine guns are traveling in interstate commerce or something to that effect. And that ruling was a bit of a surprise. The courts have not been striking down bans on the possession of machine guns. It suggests that he is quite interested in the revival of constitutional limits on Congress's power. And there's no question that Senator Specter, among others, will be a little concerned about that.
You mentioned that part of Judge Alito's opinion was based on his interpretation of the Interstate Commerce Clause. Now, the Interstate Commerce Clause has been at the center of some judges' judicial philosophy. Why is this clause such a focus of attention and a way that we kind of try to read somebody's judicial philosophy now?
Okay, it's a really big deal. And the simple reason is that much of what Congress does under the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Civil Rights Acts, and much more, much of this comes under the commerce power. So Congress, insofar as it's protecting rights, often is acting in the under the provision of the Constitution that allows it to regulate interstate commerce. Now, a lot of people think that Congress has taken the Commerce Clause too broadly, and that when Congress tries to regulate, for example, possession of marijuana or possession of machine guns or some violations of civil rights, or tries to protect endangered species in one state, a lot of people think that Congress has exceeded its constitutional authority. Now, if they prevail, we could see a very fundamental change in how our government is structured. It could be that laws that have been on the books a long, long time will all of a sudden be invalid. And Judge Roberts actually, as judge, raised the possibility that the Endangered Species Act would be unconstitutional as applied to purely intrastate activity. And now Judge Alito has said in a much more dramatic opinion than Judge Roberts' quite cautious one, Judge Alito says that the possession of machine guns cannot constitutionally be criminalized by Congress. It can by the states, of course, but not by Congress. And that will concern Senator Specter and several others who are aware that under the leadership of Chief Justice Rehnquist, the Supreme Court has struck down over 30 acts of Congress since 1995. That's a huge number. And these people are concerned, these senators are concerned, conservatives as well as liberals, that the court will prevent them from doing what they believe to be their constitutional job. And this is a, for people who think that way, as Senator Specter does, this opinion by Judge Alito is a warning sign. It suggests that he is with those who are interested in reading the Constitution to restrict Congress's power under the Commerce Clause.
So can you explain just a little bit more on what grounds certain laws are being ruled unconstitutional because of the justice's interpretation of the Interstate Commerce Clause?
Yes, some justices believe, for example, that if Congress tries to penalize violence against women, as it did, by creating a civil rights action that women would have against those who committed violence against them, then it's not regulating interstate commerce, that this can be just within one state. What does this have to do with interstate commerce? So a majority of the court said in striking down a provision of the Violence Against Women Act, the dissenters said, look, violence against women has interstate effects. If there's a lot of violence in New York that's against women, then women aren't going to travel to New York. So this does affect interstate commerce. The majority of the court disagreed, and so a provision of the Violence Against Women Act was struck down, and many members of Congress, Republicans as well as Democrats, didn't like that.
What are some of the other laws that you think might be challenged?
Well, the Clean Water Act and some of its applications is now constitutionally vulnerable. No question about that. If the Clean Water Act is being used to protect against pollution in a body of water that's just within one state, well, then there could be a constitutional challenge to the Clean Water Act. So, too, there are hate crimes laws that are designed to protect against hate crimes based on race and other grounds, race and religion. Hate crimes laws enacted at the federal level would be constitutionally vulnerable under this view because many hate crimes don't have an obvious connection with interstate commerce. As I've already mentioned, the Endangered Species Act often applies to behavior that really just occurs within one state, where, for example, a landowner is taking steps that will eliminate an endangered species. Many members of Congress think that when an endangered species is eliminated, that by its nature affects interstate commerce because scientists and others often want to travel to see these species, and also their ecological functions, it's said, that many species perform that cross state lines. Those who doubt this argue that, well, if the endangered species is just within one state and there's no commerce in it, then Congress really lacks the constitutional power to do anything about it. At the extreme, some of the civil rights laws might be constitutionally vulnerable. And we did have a fight about that in the 1960s. But if you have a civil rights law, for example, that forbids a restaurant that just does business within one state from discriminating on the basis of race, what does that have to do with interstate commerce? Some would ask. Now, it may be that the precedent that upholds the civil rights laws is so entrenched that no one will take it on. But we can see the direction of the law that Judge Alito, at least, signals in suggesting that the possession of machine guns is something that Congress can't reach without showing a connection to interstate commerce.
So the interpretation of the Interstate Commerce Clause that Judge Alito has demonstrated is an interpretation that would lead toward more federal deregulation.
Yeah, it would lead toward more restrictions on Congress's power to act on the ground that there's a connection between what it's doing and interstate commerce. And Judge Alito's position here, I should add, is well-reasoned and not without support in what the Supreme Court has said. But notice that he dissented, and the majority of the court thought that the possession of machine guns could be reached by Congress. And the dissent is a signal that that what you describe rightly as a form of deregulation via constitutional law, he might well turn out to be interested in.
My guest is constitutional scholar Cass Sunstein. He's a professor at the University of Chicago Law School and author of the book Radicals in Robes, Why Extreme Right-Wing Courts Are Wrong for America. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is constitutional scholar Cass Sunstein. He's a law professor at the University of Chicago Law School and author of the book Radicals in Robes. If Judge Alito is confirmed, how do you think his confirmation would change the makeup of the court?
Probably a lot. Justice O'Connor, whom he'd replace, was often unpredictable. And what really marked her was she was and is a minimalist. That is, someone who focuses on the particular facts of the particular case and often refuses to venture far from the narrow issue at hand, and who whose decisions often couldn't be forecast. So when the court upholds affirmative action programs or refuses to overrule Roe against Wade or upholds campaign finance regulation or allows Congress to regulate commercial advertising, she's often been the key vote. Now, to read Judge Alito on any of these issues as having a definite view would be too speculative. On the other hand, as a lower court judge, he has shown both a high degree of competence and a high degree of predictability. And that suggests that we would probably see some movement in the court toward conservative rulings on most of these issues.
Most of which issues?
Most of the great issues that are now dominating public discussion, such as campaign finance regulation, affirmative action programs, restrictions on commercial advertising, the constitutional legitimacy of the Endangered Species Act, the protection of property rights, which has gotten a lot of attention in the last year. On these issues, it's likely, based on his lower court rulings, that he would be most of the time with Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas.
When Judge Alito was nominated by the elder President Bush for the appeals court, he was unanimously confirmed. And now he's a hotly contested nominee. What's changed? Why unanimous in the early 90s and hotly contested in 2005?
The difference between a lower court and the Supreme Court, the stakes are much higher. So a lot of people, Republicans or Democrats, would happily vote for someone to a lower court where the discretion is limited, but they wouldn't vote for the same person for the Supreme Court where the discretion is significant.
We've all heard that Judge Alito's nickname is Scalito because of the similarities he's perceived to have to Justice Scalia. Do you think he's similar to Justice Scalia in his judicial philosophy?
In some ways, yes. In many ways, no. He has a very different style. So I think the Scalito moniker is more just because the names sound a little bit alike than because they are really similar. That is, Judge Alito is low-key, and Justice Scalia is not low-key. Justice Scalia is one of the best writers in the history of the federal judiciary. Judge Alito is a solid, clear writer, but he has none of the, let's say, panache and imagination in his writing that Justice Scalia shows. Justice Scalia has a well-worked-out theory of constitutional interpretation that he developed as an academic, which is that the Constitution means what the ratifiers thought it meant. Judge Alito has not supported that view. One dimension along which they're sort of similar is that Judge Alito does believe that ordinary laws should be interpreted to fit with their text. That is, he insists text is our lodestar, and Justice Scalia is on the same track on that point. Also, Justice Scalia, of course, has a largely conservative set of voting patterns on most issues. He is unquestionably conservative. Judge Alito also, despite being low-key and kind of cautious in his opinions, shows really very conservative voting patterns. He's a very different judge than Scalia. Scalia is someone who you could kind of tell was an academic. His mind goes toward a theory. Judge Alito, you can tell, was a lawyer. His mind goes toward toward really the details of the law. So their styles are fundamentally different.
So what are you expecting from the hearings?
I think they will be extremely lively hearings. I think that many of the Democrats and some of the Republicans will be concerned not about Judge Alito's competence, not about his character, but about his predictability, thinking that judges should have a measure of unpredictability, that in a way that's a credit to them. I also think there's going to be a tremendous amount of spinning by both sides in a way that will characterize Judge Alito as very different from what he is, which is a highly competent, low-key, unfailingly courteous, respectful, and quite conservative judge.
Cass Sunstein, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Cass Sunstein is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School and author of the book Radicals in Robes, Why Extreme Right-Wing Courts Are Wrong for America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. And from Image Entertainment, presenting Bill Maher, I'm Swiss. Political satirist Bill Maher takes a funny look at American life on DVD November 1st. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The neoconservative magazine, The Weekly Standard, is celebrating its 10th anniversary. Coming up, we talk with founding editor William Kristol. Then we'll hear from Daniel Benjamin and Stephen Simon. In their new book, The Next Attack, they say the invasion of Iraq has turned the country into a laboratory for terrorists.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The neoconservative magazine, The Weekly Standard, is celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. Now there's a new book collecting selected articles from those 10 years. My guest, William Kristol, is the founding editor of the magazine and editor of the new book. Kristol was an advocate of invading Iraq. The new book includes an article he co-wrote in 1997 titled Saddam Must Go. We began by discussing the Supreme Court. Kristol told me he's very enthusiastic about the president's nominee, Judge Samuel Alito.
Well, he just has a consistent pattern, I think really like Roberts and like other leading conservative constitutionalists, of not believing that the courts should intervene excessively, unless it's required by the text of the Constitution, to drive legislative outcomes. He's been deferential to legislatures, local city councils, state legislatures, the Congress as a judge. I think he will continue to do that in the Supreme Court. Obviously, one has to intervene when basic rights are at stake. But I think the courts have gone way overboard in the last 20 or 30 years, and I think a much more limited judicial role is healthy for self-government.
Now, when Harriet Myers was nominated, you wrote a column that was headlined, "I'm disappointed, depressed, and demoralized." What did you do, besides writing that column, if anything, to put pressure on President Bush to withdraw the nomination?
All I did is say that I thought Myers was a poor choice. She didn't have the qualifications, really, to be a Supreme Court justice, or certainly not to be a first-rate Supreme Court justice. And then the more that came out, the weaker a choice it seemed.
I thought that a lot of conservatives weren't confident enough that she would be anti-abortion and weren't confident enough of her conservative credentials.
Yeah, I thought Myers was kind of a wild card in terms of how she might rule constitutionally on the court. And I think it's ridiculous at this stage to put someone on the Supreme Court who doesn't have a well-developed judicial philosophy. If liberals, Larry Tribe has a very different judicial philosophy than Samuel Alito, and he's entitled to say that Alito's philosophy is bad for the country and not the kind of philosophy we want Supreme Court judges to have. That's an intelligent debate to have. I thought the Myers debate degenerated pretty quickly on the part of her backers, actually, in the White House, to a kind of coded appeal to conservatives, don't worry about her philosophy, she'll rule in the right way, which I don't think is appropriate. I'm much happier to have, I think Alito will be a much better justice than Myers would have been, but I also think the debate over Alito will be a much more elevated and appropriate debate than the sniping that we ended up having on both sides of the Myers nomination.
Let me move on to the indictment of Scooter Libby. What's your reaction to Patrick Fitzgerald's indictment and the grand jury's indictment?
I guess I have several reactions. I mean, Scooter Libby's a friend or friendly acquaintance. He's not a close friend, but I've certainly known him for 15 years. We worked together in the first Bush administration. I like him and I respect him, and I'm sorry that he got indicted, and obviously hope, frankly, that he's acquitted in the sense, or hope he's innocent, and therefore is acquitted. Obviously, we don't know. We haven't seen his side of the story. We haven't seen all of Fitzgerald's side of the story either. Politically, I think, whatever happens with Libby, I think the opponents of the Bush administration, who hope this would be a major blow to the future of the Bush administration, I think will end up being disappointed. I mean, whatever happens with Scooter Libby, we're going to have a trial in which one person will be accused of lying about three conversations with three journalists, basically. And there's not going to be brought to court any kind of massive conspiracy to falsify evidence or even to out a covert CIA officer if Mrs. Wilson was at that stage.
Well, the indictment is for, lying to the grand jury and obstructing justice. But, the underlying question seems to be, did he intentionally try to discredit Joseph Wilson because Joe Wilson wrote a column contradicting the Bush administration's statements about Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction? In other words, the underlying question here seems to be, or an underlying question seems to be, have members of the Bush administration, or has this particular member of the Bush administration, tried to discredit critics by revealing, in this case, information about his wife?
Well, I think members of the Bush administration are entitled to challenge critics, and most of what Libby and many other people did, and they did this publicly, of course, is say that there were inaccuracies in Wilson's column, which there were. We've reported on them in the Weekly Standard, and that the whole question of weapons of mass destruction wasn't fairly presented by Wilson, etc. you know, in terms of the wife, and that really came up sort of incidentally in the sense of, well, why did the CIA pick someone who was already a vocal critic of the Bush administration to send on this trip? Not an unreasonable question to ask if you're in the Bush White House. And in fact, part of the answer may have been that his wife suggested him for the trip, or it occurred to the other people in that meeting that she was in that he would be an appropriate candidate, because they might have known him through his wife. In any case, the notion that this was some, you know, well-organized massive smear, I think, is just clearly wrong. The indictment specifies five conversations with three reporters, three with Judy Miller, one with Tim Russert, in which Libby, according to Russert, did not actually mention Joseph Wilson's wife, and then one with Matthew Cooper that's really de minimis. So really what it comes down to is that Libby did apparently tell Judy Miller a couple of times that one reason Wilson might have been picked for this trip was because of his wife, something Judy Miller, incidentally, didn't publish. So that's it. I mean, this was not a massive attempt to go after Joseph Wilson's wife. It may have been wrong to even mention it to the degree they did, and it may have been illegal, and certainly was illegal, if it's true that Libby lied about what he later on lied to a grand jury about what he had said to journalists. But I think the notion, again, that there was this massive conspiracy to go after Joe Wilson's wife just isn't true.
My guest is William Kristol, the founding editor of The Weekly Standard and editor of the new book, The Weekly Standard, A Reader, 1995 to 2005. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is William Kristol, the founding editor of the neoconservative magazine The Weekly Standard. He's edited a new 10th anniversary book collecting selected articles. October has been the fourth deadliest month in Iraq so far, with about 92 American soldiers killed. An estimated 25,900 Iraqis have been killed or wounded so far since the invasion. And last week we reached the number of 2,000 American casualties in Iraq. Many counterterrorism experts say that Iraq has actually become a laboratory for training terrorists. As someone who strongly advocated the invasion, how do you think we're doing?
Well, I think it was necessary to remove Saddam, and I strongly support that decision. I think we've made mistakes in executing it. I think we're doing better now, and I think we're going to win.
What does winning mean now?
Well, winning means crushing the terrorists, or at least reducing the threat from the terrorists to what is sort of a livable threat. And most of all, winning means leaving a decent democratic Iraqi government in place so that Iraq is no threat to its neighbors and no threat to acquire weapons of mass destruction, and indeed an example, I think, of self-government and self-determination in the Arab world. And I'm pretty optimistic about that. We've made mistakes, and the Sunnis in particular have been more resistant to being part of a pluralistic Iraq in which their rights would be respected, but in which they would obviously be a minority, and have therefore provided more succor, more support to the jihadists and the terrorists and the insurgents than one would have hoped. But I think they are understanding now that they need to participate in the political process, that we're not going to be driven out, that terror is not going to restore them to preeminence in Iraq. And I think actually if we stay the course for another year or two, I'm pretty optimistic that we end up with a pretty good outcome in Iraq.
In a column you wrote in February of 2002, you wrote that American and alliance forces will be welcomed in Baghdad as liberators. Indeed, reconstructing Iraq may prove to be a less difficult task than the challenge of building a viable state in Afghanistan. Some counterterrorism experts and foreign policy experts say that kind of confidence that many people in the Bush administration had, that they shared with you, that we would be welcomed as liberators, prevented us from adequately preparing for the reality of what we are facing now, which is a very strong insurgency.
We have mostly been welcomed as liberators. Most of the Iraqis are happy that we removed Saddam and happy that we're there, clearly. We're not fighting a massive guerrilla wars supported by millions of Iraqis. Now, I also wished we had gone in with more troops and was critical of the administration at the time for not doing so, and think that would have helped a lot. And there are plenty of mistakes we made in the last 2.5 years that have probably let the insurgency get more traction than it needed to. You get some good breaks and you get some tougher situations. If the war was worth fighting, it was worth fighting at this cost. If it wasn't worth fighting, then we shouldn't have fought it. But this notion that we're going to count casualties each month and say, well, this month there were 92 casualties, and last month there were 76, and next month there might be 110, and then the month after that 65, that's not determinative one way or the other, obviously. If it's worth fighting, it's worth fighting at a cost of 2,000 American deaths. If it wasn't worth fighting, we shouldn't have fought it, even if we could have done so with 400 American deaths.
But, you know, I think a lot of Americans feel betrayed because this isn't what we were told was going to happen. It's not even what we were told the war was about. I mean, we were told the war was about weapons of mass destruction. You know, we'd be welcomed as liberators, that we weren't told to prepare for the kind of cost that in either money or life that we've proved to be paying.
Well, look. I don't think that's quite fair on the second point. I'll get back to weapons of mass destruction on the first point. Let me do weapons of mass destruction first. We believed they were there. The Clinton administration believed they were there. The UN inspectors believed they were there. Everyone believed they were there, and Saddam did nothing to prove that they weren't there. And it just turned out he was bluffing. It seemed to he thought it suited his advantage to pretend he had the weapons of mass destruction. So I think we went to war honestly, and I don't think anyone at the time thought the weapons of mass destruction weren't there. So I think that's not a fair charge. Now, should our intelligence be better? Sure, but it wasn't really based on exotic U.S. intelligence. It was based on U.N. inspectors' reports and a consensus of the international community, and the fact that he, of course, had weapons of mass destruction. On the second point, you know, the Bush administration perhaps should have warned more explicitly ahead of time that wars are difficult and unpredictable, that you can't know ahead of time how something like this is going to turn out. I think, to be fair to the president, certainly once we were engaged there, that's been his general tone. He ran for re-election in 2004 without promising that it was going to be easy, without promising a quick withdrawal. So suddenly, I will stipulate that everything hasn't gone as well as I would have liked it to have gone, and I'm sure most Americans would have liked it to have gone. And we don't know, obviously, ultimately, whether it will end up, how much it will end up making the world safer or making the world more dangerous. I think if we stick to it and if we prevail, it will make the world a lot more safer. But obviously, some people disagree with that.
Bill Kristol, you are the founding editor of The Weekly Standard, which is this year celebrating its 10th anniversary, and now you've edited a new anthology collecting articles from The Weekly Standard. Before you founded The Weekly Standard, you were chief of staff for Vice President Dan Quayle. What's the difference between the kind of influence you have when you're a close advisor to a vice president and the kind of influence that you have when you're editing a publication that's very closely read in many political circles, particularly in neoconservative circles?
Well, the great thing about editing a magazine or writing for a magazine is that you say what you think, and you're not part of a team. You don't have to sort of defend things you think are indefensible. Believe me, lots of times in the last few weeks during the Harriet Myers nomination, I thank my lucky stars I wasn't in the Bush at the White House and would have to either just keep my mouth shut or go out and sort of valiantly and painfully defend something I thought was really a foolish idea. And of course, that's what you do if you're on a team in politics and government. You don't lie for your guys, but you certainly don't tell the whole truth. It's fun editing a magazine where you try to call it as you see it. I don't know how much influence we have. That's so hard to disentangle. If you have influence editing a magazine, you put ideas out there. You try to influence the debate. You never know who's going to pick up what. I found I have a very bad record predicting which of our articles or which of our issues is going to make a difference. Something I think is really important and I think could really change the way people think about some part of the world, you know, kind of comes out and people read it and it kind of goes nowhere. Something else that I personally might have thought, well, this is kind of repeating something we've said 2 or 3 times, suddenly catches on. But it's a very good group. I really enjoyed it, I will say. I enjoyed being in government. But it's a different kind of influence, obviously, from sitting in a White House senior staff meeting and trying to make a case for this policy or that. I was Dan Quayle's chief of staff. We were pretty powerless, frankly, within the White House. Dan Quayle, whom I like and respect, and I think he got a bum rap, he wasn't anything like Dick Cheney in terms of influence as vice president, and I sure wasn't anything like Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, in terms of influence as a vice presidential chief of staff. And now with Scooter's indictment, maybe it was just as well that I was sort of unimportant and uninfluential.
Are you feeling a sense of relief?
Well, not quite. I mean, I don't want to feel relief at Scooter's expense. As I say, I've known him and I respect him. I'm sorry for what happened to him, but there is a way in which you... I just never was nearly as central to anything as he's been, obviously.
Well, congratulations on your 10th anniversary, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
William Kristol is the founding editor of The Weekly Standard and editor of the new book, The Weekly Standard, A Reader, 1995 to 2005. Coming up, a new book that says we're losing the war on terrorism. This is Fresh Air. Book about the war on terror begins with this short sentence: "We are losing." In that book, The Next Attack, Daniel Benjamin and Stephen Simon write, "The number of terrorists is growing, as is the pool of people who may be moved to violence." The authors make the case that Iraq has become a laboratory for terrorists. Benjamin is senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. From 1994 to 1999, he was director of counterterrorism at the National Security Council. Simon teaches at Georgetown University and served on the National Security Council staff for 5 years. Benjamin and Simon's previous book was the bestseller, The Age of Sacred Terror. One of the measures of success that President Bush has used to show that we're doing well in the war against terrorism is that there hasn't been a terrorist attack on the United States since September 11th. You argue that one of the reasons why there hasn't been an attack on American soil since September 11th is that the jihadists are getting what they need in Iraq. What do you mean by that?
Well, Iraq... As we point out in the book, is the jihadists' field of dreams. It enables them to do several things simultaneously. First, target Americans. Now, U.S. forces have increasingly moved into a cantonment posture, which reduces their exposure to attack. So casualties are somewhat down, although the level of attacks is very high. But first of all, they can kill Americans. And secondly, they can humiliate the United States by demonstrating daily that it is not in control of conditions in Iraq.
How does the London subway bombing change the story of what the terrorists are doing and what we need to do to try to stop further attacks?
The London attacks exemplified a couple of developments. One is what we call self-starters. Yeah, these guys from Leeds or the surrounding towns, none of them had been identified with the radical causes until shortly before these attacks. Not all of them were especially pious. But they had become so enraged by international events against the background of their feelings of marginalization within British society that they became easy prey for an ideology that spread not by word of mouth, but through the media. They also demonstrated the sort of transitional state we believe the jihad is in, between the old centralized control of attacks you know, those that were ordered by the al-Qaeda of old from Afghanistan, and this self-starter phenomenon. And the link between these two phases in the London case lies in the way al-Qaeda, after the attacks, made use of those attacks to propagate its message. And the link is especially curious, I mean intriguing really, because they had obtained at some point, probably on a visit by the attackers to Pakistan, a videotape of one of the attackers talking about his intentions to carry out these suicide attacks. So, you know, there is still a residual linkage, but the recruitment of the attackers was entirely spontaneous. They recruited themselves.
You both believe that the war in Iraq has made us more vulnerable to terrorism and has increased the number of terrorists who would like to attack us. Did the Bush administration have any warnings that this might be a consequence of war in Iraq? Did they have any warnings of this before the invasion?
They certainly did. They did not ask the intelligence community what the consequences of the invasion would be, but the intelligence community did write a number of papers and issue warnings about the likely consequences of an occupation of Iraq. And according to our sources, none of this got any real reaction, except one senior intelligence official told me he got one note back saying, "Oh, you guys are just way too pessimistic. You don't realize all the opportunities that are out there for us." But no, this was definitely something that the intelligence community was deeply concerned about.
You think that one of the biggest mistakes we made in the planning of the war in Iraq was assuming that Americans would be greeted as liberators. Are there certain things, what are some of the things you think that America didn't plan for and therefore caught us in a vulnerable state? The things that we didn't plan for because we expected to have this really positive, welcoming reception.
Well, one thing was the decision to disband the Ba'athist Army, the Iraqi Army. This, if there was one single decision taken before we went in that had devastating implications for us, it was that. What we discovered interviewing very widely among senior officials who served with the Bush administration is that the decision to disband the Army was never vetted. It never went through the canonical policy decision-making process. This was a decision that was taken completely offline and with very serious consequences for the occupation.
Why was this decision taken offline?
Well, the run-up to the war and the post-war were handled as sort of proprietary matters, as the exclusive concerns of the Department of Defense and the Office of the Vice President. To bring us back to the news of the week with the Libya indictment, those offices wanted to make sure that the State Department, which was not viewed as loyal, and other parts of the government, for example, CIA, which was also not viewed as loyal, would not raise any objections to these policy decisions. And as a result, they just took place out of channels. You know, one of the interesting pieces of news recently was were the statements of Larry Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff and who was actually a source for our book, about a parallel process in the government outside of the traditional one involving the National Security Council, which brings together all the cabinet officials. And this parallel process played a vital role in the entire policymaking regarding Iraq. And we found lots and lots of evidence of that.
Scooter Libby was the aide to Vice President Dick Cheney. What was the vice president's office's part in the lead up to the war in Iraq?
The first was simply driving the train. And one of the things that we uncover in this book that I don't think has been discussed earlier was that the office of the vice president had a critical role in getting the government focused on going to war in Iraq far earlier than anyone has really discussed before. That is to say, they were meeting in January of 2002 about the possibility of going to war within 3 or 4 months. And this is extraordinary when you remember that we're already at war in Afghanistan in this period, and no connection to Iraq has been made in terms of the 9/11 attacks. The vice president's office played a central role in constructing the justification for the war. The vice president himself said on numerous occasions that there was a connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam. He continually spoke about a purported meeting between Mohammed Atta, the 9/11 conspirator, in Prague with Iraqi intelligence, although both the CIA and the FBI knocked this argument down. He continued to say it. The vice president played an absolutely critical role. You know, it was his speech in August of 2002 that really made it clear to the entire world that the United States was determined to go to war.
You've told us about some of the mistakes you think we've made on the war on terror. What is one of the things that you think we should be doing that we're not?
We've had a counterterrorism policy that is 100% offense. And that's okay to a point because you want to get the bad guys. We've over-militarized it in that we went into Iraq. But what we don't have is a political strategy to isolate extremists from moderates and to convince moderates that we're okay and they should be on our side. On the contrary, we've alienated a lot of moderates, and we've given a boost to the ideology of our opponents. So we need a radical redrawing of this strategy. And until we have that, and I don't think it's possible, by the way, until we're out of Iraq, but until we have that, the hole's just going to get deeper.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel Benjamin and Stephen Simon are the authors of The Next Attack, The Failure of the War on Terror, and A Strategy for Getting It Right. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Alzheimer's Association, working to accelerate progress toward prevention and cure and helping people living with Alzheimer's. Information at alz.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
In Jimmy Carter's new book, Our Endangered Values, he draws on his own experiences as president and as a born-again Baptist to explain why he's worried about the blurring line between church and state. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with President Carter. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.